Klaus, thank you so very much. Thank you, everyone. I've just returned from an 8-day trip around the world. No, it wasn't in a balloon. 8 days. So if I lapse into incoherence, I'm simply speaking in a different time zone. And since one of my destinations was Bangladesh, it could be in Bengali, a language I don't even know I know. So I ask you to bear with me as I share with you my sense of disorientation from this trip and attempt to address this enormous topic which this meeting of the Philadelphia Society has taken upon itself, and which I so applaud it for doing. It's called the Sources of Renewal, I think, and that actually was the area in which I prepared my remarks, but then I noticed tonight that I'm supposed to talk about the prospects of renewal. But since I'm going to speak incoherently, you won't be able to tell whether I'm addressing the one subject or the other. Well, I was in Bangladesh, one of the poorest countries in the world, population of 130 million people, mainly Muslim. I was there to inaugurate a new VOA FM station in Dhaka, an impoverished city of 10 million people. I took a boat ride up one of the tributaries of the Ganges for an hour, and a little wooden bridge dropped down, and I went into a village of corrugated huts, which was the location of one of the 1,000 Bengali VOA fan clubs. And lining the entrance to the village were these lovely young women throwing flower petals at me and in my path, and I thought, this has never happened in Washington. If I have to go halfway around the world for this, it's worth it. But the most extraordinary thing about this experience in this quite obscure location was the VOA Fan Club magazine. What did it contain? An article on the Constitution? On the Bill of Rights? On the history of the Voice of America, 44 years of which has been in the Bangla language, and an article on the polio eradication efforts which these many VOA fan clubs have been a part of successfully in eradicating polio from that country. I really can't express to you how touched I was in this village, festooned with American flags, posters, Voice of America, paraphernalia, that this meant so much to them. I'm in a village where these people lived on less than $1 a day. In Dhaka, I had been with the thought leaders, political leaders, and cabinet ministers of the country, but I'm in a village where the people may have largely been illiterate, where this meant so much to them. And I was reminded of something well before I had the hope that President George Bush would appoint me as the director of the Voice of America, though I was already working at the Voice of America in a minor capacity, of something he said in his inaugural speech that absolutely thrilled me. Because as soon as he said it, I said, he's talking about the Voice of America. And here were those brief words during his inauguration. Quote, our democratic faith is more than the creed of our country. Now it is a seed upon the wind, taking root in many nations. Well, I like to think that that seed is the content of our programming, and that that wind are the frequencies over which that content is broadcast. And then I saw how that was planted in this little village in Bangladesh and what it meant to those people. It was an experience that really brought me very close to tears when I saw it. The Voice of America is not going to be my subject tonight, though I have renamed the institution. I now call it Veritas Operans in Adversis, Truth Operating in Adversity. And I have approached Congress with the prospect that we start a 54th language service in Latin, but I'm meeting some resistance. I keep talking about the democracy of the dead. Joe Morris, remember, Cook County, they vote. What's wrong with this? In any case, as silly as that suggestion may sound to you, I had the occasion of seeing an old friend from the Reagan era, who is now the Minister of Communications to our Holy Father, Archbishop Foley, who told me that Radio Vatican has a broadcast in Esperanto, which made me feel so much better about some of the silly things we do. And even better, when the Holy Father himself was asked on one occasion, how many people work at Radio Vatican? He stopped and thought and said, about half. I think we're doing a little better than that. Now, my next stop in this eight days around the world was in London. And last Sunday, I picked up the London Observer and came across this curious article, which I'll read you the headline and several excerpts. Bishops warn Blair over danger of creationism. Leading clerics and scientists have warned Downing Street about their, quote, growing anxiety, unquote, over the spread of faith schools in Britain. It goes on to say that this growing anxiety follows last month's, and it's curious they choose this, last month's revelation that Gateshead's Emmanuel City Technology College has included creationism, the doctrine that claims human origins are recent and divine in biology lessons. Now, no one can blame the bishops for having been concerned about this, because if you allow this kind of teaching in the schools, pretty soon it's going to be in the churches. Next, I returned to Washington, D.C., where I picked up a newspaper and I read the following thing. Life, human life, is a creation, not a commodity. And that wasn't said by a bishop, that was said by President George W. Bush. A man who understands the sanctity of human life, as he so eloquently put it forward 2 days ago in his statement totally opposing any human cloning. On February 25th, we began the celebration of VOA's 60th anniversary, and President Bush was gracious enough to come over to VOA to help us to inaugurate our anniversary year. And of course, we all have these Walter Mitty moments. I mean, we solipsists always have these Walter Mitty moments of, well, if I had a chance to say something to the president, you know, what would it be? And this, of course, is something over which I've worried long. And though on such public occasions, there's very seldom a private moment in which to say something, I did have it. Actually, I said this in front of someone else when I met him. I said, you know, Mr. President, I want to thank you very much for the privilege you've given me in serving you in this capacity. Don't mess up. He said, thank you, that's reassuring. I said, actually, I have a problem. He looked at me and I said, my daughter Catherine has informed her mother that she loves you more than her father. And when her mother asked her why, Catherine said, well, he's the president, you know? So I got a nice, Catherine got a note from the president on that one. But on a little more serious note, when we did have a private moment, and I had always wondered what I would like to say to him, before we walked on stage together, I leaned forward and said, I want you to know, Mr. President, how much it means to be led by a man of faith in a time of national crisis. And I think that has made the difference for all of us, for all our nation, and why it has pulled us all together as a people. The problem we're facing is an interior one, despite the exterior damage we have suffered. Those of you who have heard I occasionally write on the subject of music won't be surprised that I quote Igor Stravinsky here. The stained glass artist of Chartres had few colors, and the stained glass artists of today have hundreds of colors, but no Chartres. Not enlarged resources then, but men and what they believe. The so-called crisis of means is interior. And that's what I want to spend a little time speaking incoherently about this evening. You know, renewal is built into the American experience. No one would know this better than Forrest MacDonald, whom the society has so appropriately honored this evening. It's built into the American experience because the founders didn't think they were inventing anything, but they were renewing that which is fundamentally and eternally true. And to renew the understanding behind those founding documents, one must recover the background to them. And in order to do that, I'm going to indulge myself in the recitation of a series of truisms tonight. And as G.K. Chesterton once said, that the only problem with truisms is that you forget that they're true. And it takes kind of an effort to recapture the truth of a truism. I mean, it's like noticing oxygen. You know, you're breathing it effortlessly and you don't notice until it's not there. And I'll do this in semaphore by mentioning a few things because you are all conversant in them. Many of you have spoken to these very subjects far more eloquently than I can in this short period of time. How short it is, only Klaus knows, because he'll start waving his arms at me when I've exceeded my, oh, it's already over. I'm ready for questions. Nonetheless, it's a tale of four cities. Four cities that have contributed something seminal to the American experience. Athens, Jerusalem, Rome, surprise, Philadelphia is our fourth city. Now, the unstated premises without which the American experience is incomprehensible derive respectively from these four cities. From Jerusalem, monotheism, the fundamental goodness and reliability of creation, and a rational universe created by a rational God. From Athens, the immutability of nature, the existence of human nature, and the existence and immortality of the human soul. From Rome, the de-divinization of the world, salvation, history, and a personal God. It's far beyond the scope of my brief remarks to completely unpack the significance of each of those contributions. But to begin simply with Jerusalem, a city very much in the news today. Quite apart from any other experience in the ancient world, the Israelites, repeatedly defeated in battle, unlike any other tribe, refused to abandon their God. This was extraordinary. Simply because if your city was defeated in battle, it meant that the God of your city had been defeated in battle, and the only decent thing to do was to accede to the God of the conquering city of that battle. The only people who refused to do this in the ancient world were indeed the Israelites. And the Old Testament is a record of the developing consciousness on their part of their God as not a tribal God, but as one who is transcendent, omniscient, one who creates ex nihilo and who creates only that which is good. He who is not just a tribal God, he is the God of all people and all things. The Book of Wisdom, called Naturally Stupid, those men who from the good things that are seen have not been able to discover him who is, or who, although studying those works, fail to recognize the artificer. Elsewhere in the Book of Wisdom, the goodness of creation is reinforced with the notion that the animating purpose behind creation was love. It says of Yahweh, "You love all that exists. You hold nothing of what you have made in abhorrence, for had you hated anything, you would not have formed it." Now, our familiarity with these texts, or at least their assertions, has robbed us of the astonishing uniqueness of the biblical idea that creation is good and that indeed, in fact, God is good. You know, I saw Moloch or Baal or Baal in Istanbul. It's one of the most horrifying sights I have ever encountered. In the Museum of Antiquities in Istanbul, there was Moloch two stories high, this devourer of infants, to whom human sacrifice was made. I have also seen the monumental statuary of some of the Aztec gods. This could be repeated through the cosmology of any number of ancient religions in which the universe was seen as an arena in contention between good and evil demiurges. Creation was not something good in and of itself, but was an area of contestation between a principle of good and a principle of evil, and the status of the struggle between the two could be seen in the eruptions in nature of volcanoes and floods and catastrophes, and of course in the interior life of man it could be seen and experienced in the struggle between good and evil. But was creation itself good within this Manichaean and Gnostic vision? No, of course it wasn't good. It wasn't. It was polluted. Was God good? There was no single God. There were demiurges in contention over the status of reality. So the very statement that creation is good and that there is one good God over it is an extraordinary revelation, the uniqueness of which it is almost impossible for us to recapture. We have lived with it for so long, and without which there would never, ever be anything like the U.S. Constitution, Declaration, or institutions of our government. Now, the Athenian contribution was, of course, the discovery of philosophy, through which came the articulation of human nature. The single greatest act of civilization, or the defining act of civilization, is the ability to recognize another person as a human being. And from the point at which that discovery was made, we have forever since called those incapable of that act barbarians. A barbarian is someone who is incapable of recognizing another person as a human being. As Adolf Hitler said, we are barbarians, we want to be barbarians, it is an honorable title. That pretty clearly defines some of the markers in the 20th century through the rebarbarization of man, but I'm referring to the classical era in which, at first, this great philosophical discovery of man's nature was conceived by the Greeks that allowed one to recognize another person as a human being, not as a member of another tribe. And this meant that there was a single standard of justice that applied to all people everywhere and at all times. One of the single most beautiful things I think ever written was by Socrates or Plato in The Republic, in which, alluding to this transcendent standard by which all men might be judged everywhere and at all times, he said, quote, in heaven there is laid up a pattern of it, that is the ideal city in which there is perfect justice, which he who desires may behold. If you desire, you may come to know what this is. And beholding may set his own house in order. You can order your own soul to this truth. But whether such a one exists or will ever exist, in fact, does not matter, for he will live after the manner of that city, having nothing to do with any other, unquote. In other words, it is not the city in which you live, it is not the tribal gods under whom you live that define your existence or your ultimate allegiance, but this higher standard of justice which transcends the political order, and that the order of your soul can never be satisfied by a political order, but only by this transcendent. This statement by Socrates is really a beautiful adumbration of the statement by St. Paul in the New Testament when he says, as you well know, we have our true citizenship in heaven. Which brings us to Rome. You know, Father Stanley Yockey has spoken to this august society several times, and his contributions are always tremendous. One thing I've never forgotten from him is the significance of the use of the term monogenesis, only begotten. That monogenesis was a term used by Plutarch and Cicero and Socrates to describe the universe, the world. Monogenesis, that God had made these things, that this was the foundation of pantheism in the ancient world, that God was the world, that the world was an emanation of God. And then all of a sudden, with startling clarity, in the Gospel of St. John, we hear something else. Monogenesis is applied only to Christ. He is the only begotten. Well, if he's the only begotten, then God cannot have begotten the world. That the world, therefore, is not God. And this, in effect, was the single most powerful attack against pantheism that has ever been delivered. Pan fled the world. This de-divinized the world. All of the water sprites and spirits in the wood disappeared. Despite all of the people who want to go around and hug trees again, it's too late. The spirit of the tree left a long time ago, and they also don't know that there are some trees out there that aren't so nice. And that were they still living in that world of spirits and sprites and pantheism, you know, they'd have to probably make some human sacrifices in front of some of those trees to calm them down. So this de-divinization of the world, by the way, was an invitation to explore the world. It was considered an act of impiety to explore the world as long as the world was itself part of God. I mean, you don't go examining the viscera of God. That's impolite, if not impious, right? So once the world is de-divinized, the invitation there to examine it presents itself. And that really is the foundation of modern science, and it is the foundation of modern it's the foundation of natural law, without which, once again, no constitutional order. Again, in St. Paul, Romans 1, ever since the creation of the world, the invisible existence of God and his everlasting power have been clearly seen by the mind's understanding of created things. So, natural law is the means through which you can apprehend something about the creator of the world. The other galvanizing statement in St. John, of course, is in the beginning was the Word, and the Word was God. If God is logos, if God is reason, if God is nous, then the order that you apprehend in the universe is not a challenge to God, it is a reflection of God. It is not a limitation of God, it is a revelation of God. Once again, this lays the theological and scriptural foundation for natural law, without which there cannot be any kind of constitutional thought oriented toward limited government. Now, our founders were deeply grounded in these beliefs. They proclaimed in the Declaration of Independence that American independence is based upon total dependence on God. That is why the Constitution contains no solution to the problem of evil. The Constitution implicitly recognizes that politics cannot and should not attempt to spiritually transform man or turn the world into a terrestrial paradise. The more limited goal of politics is to arrange the material circumstances of man's life to mitigate the effects of evil so that he can pursue virtue, and in so doing achieve the ultimate happiness which lies beyond politics. The primacy of the person, about which our president spoke so movingly this week, unthinkable without the foundation of Judeo-Christian truth, defines the very order of the Constitution. The Constitution makes no sense divorced from these presuppositions. If man lives in a world of which he can make no sense, a world that is a plaything of the gods, an irrational world, he can choose only to surrender to fate or to despair. In such a state and such circumstances, he will not go about writing constitutions. For constitutions, by their very nature, imply a belief in order, in man's reasonability, and in his ability to formulate and establish a rational mode of government grounded in a rational creation. Law is reason, as John Courtney Murray once said, which is why we discuss reasons for law. If reason is simply an excrescence of material or physiological forces, then deliberations are meaningless. Freedom, obviously, is a hollow idea if free will and reason do not exist. These faculties themselves only make sense in an order of nature which directs man towards ends that make him fully human. This is the perspective that formed our founders and that infuses the Declaration of Independence and the Constitution. Now, I want to tell you, just to get back to the Voice of America for a moment, in that declaration in 1776, our founders spoke, they said, out of a decent respect for the opinions of mankind. Why ought this little huddled group of 13 colonies on the North Atlantic shore have addressed themselves to the world? Not just to George III, but to the world. Was this a giant act of presumption on their part? They didn't think so. They thought it was an act of respect. They actually thought it was an act of humility, because the principles which they advanced, they claimed to be universal truths, in the way in which I have been speaking of them as contributed by each of those respective cities, true everywhere and at all times for everyone. The Declaration of Independence was really the first public diplomacy document of the United States, because it was meant to speak directly to the peoples of other countries in the world. and because it had a direct relevance to them as it does today, as I could see in that little village in Bangladesh. The vice president of the Nigerian Senate came to visit us one morning, spoke about the relevance of our House of Service in his country, said that, of course, it's nice to have this reliable source of information and news that's objective and accurate. He said, but it was something more under the long history of military rule in our country. What the Voice of America represented to us was hope. Hope for a better future, for a democratic life, for a constitutional order. When this distinguished man said this to our morning editorial meeting of some 40, 50 people, you could have heard an extended elaboration of the Declaration of Independence. I will close, unless you want me to close now. Klaus, you haven't waved your arms yet, with a movie review. I promised you incoherence, and I'm not going to disappoint you. I thought that Saving Private Ryan was a very significant film. I don't even call it a movie. It's hard to call it a film. Films are made in Europe, and they're about life. Movies are made in America, and they're not. That's usually the distinction I draw. But Saving Private Ryan asked the central question of a democracy: what is the basis of my relationship to those around me? Or, as it was explicitly put in the movie, who is my brother? How many of you saw Saving Private Ryan? Most of you. The rest of you can go to the hospitality suite now. Who is my brother? And what are the obligations this relationship entails, even when one's own survival is at stake? So who is my brother? All right, this movie began and ended with two bookmarks. It quotes from President Lincoln to a mother who lost all her sons in the Civil War, which was the basis for the military regulation that any family will not have at risk its only male in combat if all the other males in that family have been killed, right? So this happened to Private Ryan's family, and a company is sent into combat to rescue this man. And during all of the fighting to get to Private Ryan to save him, the troops are grumbling. Well, who the hell is Private Ryan? I mean, we have families too. Why should we risk ourselves for private? So they're asking themselves the very questions that are raised. There are philosophical questions. You know, what is my relationship to this man? What obligation do I owe him within this democratic constitutional order, at war and at risk? Why is his life worth something more than mine? Why must I put it at risk to save him because he's lost his other brothers? So what? And this journey takes place as this platoon gets closer and closer to Private Ryan, and they finally discover him in a French village that is at a key choke point where the Germans are about to counterattack. And the American unit of which Private Ryan is a part has already suffered casualties, is getting ready for the counterattack, and Tom Hanks, playing the captain of the company that has come to save Private Ryan, says, "Okay, buddy, you've got a free ticket home. All your brothers were killed." And at this climactic moment, standing in a trench, he looks at both sides of himself, points, and says, "These are my brothers." And refuses to leave. As a consequence of which, the unit that came with Tom Hanks to save him, even though they're under no military obligation to stay and fight what seems a hopeless battle to hold that little town against the Germans, decide, we are going to stay. We'll stay and fight now. They have discovered the grounds for their relationship with Private Ryan, whom they wondered about, who is my brother? And he discovered who his brothers were. The battle takes place. They successfully hold off the German troops. Tom Hanks, the captain, takes a bullet. He's dying. And Private Ryan runs up to him as he expires. And what is the last word out of Tom Hanks's mouth? Earn it. Flash forward 40 years. An aging Private Ryan with his old wife and a couple children is stumbling through the grave markers in Normandy, trying to find the places where his compatriots were buried. And the closer he gets, the faster he moves, and he begins running, and he finally finds the location. And he kneels, and he begins weeping. And he looks up imploringly at his wife and says, tell me, I'm a good man. The obligation of the sacrifice of those people had placed upon him was a moral one, to be a good man, to lead a good life, as it would have been understood by Aristotle in Jerusalem, Athens, Rome, or the Philadelphia of which I spoke. Now we are in our own way at Normandy here in our little Philadelphia society. And we have some grave markers, don't we? Gerhard Niemeyer, Russell Kirk, Henry Regnery, Richard Weaver, Eric Voglin, and others. And we have to look up, don't we? And say, tell me I'm a good man. Tell me I'm a good woman. Because of the sense of obligation under which their sacrifice has placed us. So the topic tonight was the sources of renewal. And I will tell you that since that sense of obligation is one of the sources of renewal, our prospects for renewal are very good indeed. Thank you and God bless you.